you very much for coming, and thanks, Billy, for saying a few words. Billy and I first met, I think, about 10 years ago in Trinity College, and I've admired his work ever since, and I'm honoured to be introduced by him. And it's just very nice for me, for a number of reasons, to kind of complete a circle, come back to Cork, which is a place which my family lived in the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. And I thought what I would do this evening is I'd bracket some poems from a new book that I've just published, The Winter Sleep of Captain Lemass, with two poems that come from Cork. It so happens that exactly 100 years ago, in 1912, my grandmother and my grandfather, who had had met in Ballycotton, married in Cork, moved up to Dublin, and that sort of began the Dublin side of our life. She was a woman who came from Cove, and it's kind of interesting. I strolled around a bit just before this, and I went down to the monument down at the Grand Parade, and my great grandfather, her father, his name is with the name of O'Donovan Rossa on that monument. He was a Fenian. He was based in Cove, and just part of that whole enthusiasm, if you like, that early republicanism that perhaps wasn't as tainted or darkened with certain aspects that we associated with at the moment. You know, obviously Cork in 1912 was British, and that Cove was one of the main navy bases for the British. And this is a little poem based on memories of my grandmother when she was a child in 1899. Like all things associated with children, it's basically just disjointed memories and perceptions before any meaning gets attached to them. And that comes later with history, as we call it. And this is called Military Presence, Cove, 1899. Childhood. A door wide open, day or night, without fear of trespass, as long as the tides gentled Her Majesty's Navy. Why not forget? It was a year of many suicides. Everything else being equal, you are a child in a casual doorway, feeding naive plums to the suddenly orphaned. Somebody's father files past into oblivion, press ganged, a cherry bum bound for the colonies. Corpses are carted back from the place below, dredged from a deep water quay to haunt imagination. All you lack is consciousness, judgment, the 20th century. I don't think my grandmother, who was very much part of the independence struggle, was happy with the outcome. And like many Irish families, you know, I grew up with a history of embittered republicanism. You know, people who felt that it hadn't become the country that they hoped it would be. My father, after the Second World War, left Ireland. He was a civil engineer, and he went to work in South America, And he met my mother there, and they came back in 1950 to live in Dublin, probably the worst point in the economic history of the Republic, when people were emigrating. So they had some very hard years when they came back to Dublin. And I suppose my own childhood and schooling were very conditioned by the fact that, I was aware of, being very much part of an official Irishness that was pressed home to me through school and through the Irish language, and at home a kind of a resistance to that. So there was a real tension in the family. And it was added to by the fact that every so often my South American grandmother used to make very strange appearances out of nowhere. And as a child, you'd come down to breakfast and there'd be a strange woman sitting at the breakfast table, quite an exotic woman. And my parents would be talking to this woman in Spanish. And I would go to school, and when I came back from school, her suitcase would have been moved upstairs, and she'd have taken somebody's room, and nobody would really know how long she was going to be there. So the sense of mystery and tension would increase from one day to the next. And after a couple of weeks, inevitably there was a huge explosion in the house, and all sorts of shouting would break out between my mother and her mother, all this in Spanish. A taxi would take away this mysterious woman, and that would be that for about 2 years, and then the cycle would repeat itself again. And of course it's easy to feel a bit blasé about it at this point, but when you're a child, that sort of thing really can haunt you, because you're very aware that an effort is being made at normality in your home, but that something else is breezing in out of left field, which is very different and very, very influential, if you like. And so my life, I would almost say, was very influenced by this mysterious woman who I came to associate, I think, with a lot of freedoms that weren't part of ordinary domestic life. And her language, which was the Spanish language, has something to do with a mother tongue, which I also associate, I suppose, with poetry and not with everyday life. And I read a poem called Mother Tongue. I came from gypsies on my mother's side. There would be dawns in childhood when somebody strange came out of the night to sit at table. Father smoked, said nothing. Mother, in a language not of this world, wept and harangued. And the visitor just sat there, listening. A little woman, glamorous in the manner of half a century back. Her perfume like a sounding board for the senses, now at the time of writing. Barely awake in the hour of stripped illusions, bitter words, I drank the milk of origins like a godchild. Lost hotels, a long prenatal chain of wanderings. And this, our household lie, eclipsed by electric light and shattering clarities, broken into shouts, recriminations. Go inside, we'll call you. Through a wall no one breached for 20 years, I heard the taxi called. She came inside and held me to her. No one here understands me, you alone, Morcito. Years would pass, I would run away. It was out there somewhere, the mother tongue. By now, she was striking camp or putting down new roots in another town with an absolute stranger who would educate me in gambling, horses, family sagas endlessly added to, nowhere written down. One of the things my granny did was to drink mate, which at the time was slightly infradig, not spoken of, and a sign of lack of social status. This is called mate drinking. A door blows open into a vanished world. A woman sits there, mate drinking. A Rukanian Indian, my grandmother. One sip through her metal straw, then another. And a level slowly sinking in the gourd as pure reality heightens. Enter, child. There's no need to be frightened. They married me off, you see. I was only a girl, and falseness, lack of love, became my portion. Here, in the servants' quarters of Misiones, no one uses the English Delph. I speak to you now from the other side of war and orphanhood. Child, be true to yourself. Mother reaches past me, slams that door. This is something from a very different angle. I'm one of those people who perhaps wrongly imagines that he can remember when he was born, and one of the things I associate with it is a very strong sense of the colour yellow, very bright yellow light, a light sort of broken by various filigree patterns and things like that, which might have been veins or whatever. Anyway, this is something that when I go back into the earliest of childhood, I think about. I wrote a poem called Daffodils, which is an attempt to get back to that. I hunker down and see the daffodils at eye level, with the light coming through them. It has happened once before. I am being born. There is yellow light, indefinable, but absolutely pure, irradiating everything. Maybe a vein or two, my mother's or my own. The yolk of an egg, or a streak of red in a bloodshot eyeball. Either way, the world, in its primary state, being given. Ever afterwards, yellow is my colour, and it multiplies endlessly, but nothing is the same. The spring comes in. Again, it is making windows of itself, to be seen but not seen through. The poet W.H. Auden said that you should never use colours in a poem. I don't think he explained why, but I have a feeling that some poets are quite moralistic. That isn't a criticism of them, it's just that they tend to work with ideas rather with sensations, rather than with sensations. And if you work with ideas, if you're sort of comparing moralities, you probably don't need any colour words in your poems. That may be a theory of my own, but Auden certainly ruled them out as bad practice. But this is another little ode to yellowness, And it's about trying to keep a lemon tree alive in winter, in the Irish winter. And I suppose it's about something which matters a great deal to me, which is this eternal dream of the South, which, as I say, is partly connected with things in my maternal ancestry. And it's called Citrus. All lemons are green to begin with, all oranges. Ours, the nurslings of grey Irish light, turn yellow in winter. Meanwhile, through October, in the tall windows, higher than human height, incarnate joy against the logic of seasons goes on ripening. Slowly a solstice approaches, drenched in cold moonshine, when the little tree, self-pollinating, like a private mystery kept behind glass from a collapsing world, goes south in itself, beyond poverty and death, to infinite yellowness. They are selling it already on the Sicilian squares for less than nothing. As the sun moves up through the latitudes now to catch us unawares at the back end of January, still waiting in the days that never rise above themselves, to slice it for its zest against the grain of whiskey, the false lift of gin and tonic. I'd like to read this book is divided into three sections. It's quite a political book in a way. It took me an awful long time to get to a point where, you know, I could integrate some of that bitterness that I was talking about earlier, the family bitterness, into something that was sufficiently distanced and made, into an artifact. And the whole Ireland thing has been a very complicated thing for me, for partly I've understood from things I've already said on both sides of my family, and I've come and gone quite a lot from Ireland, and what I tried to do in this book, I came back to Ireland after living basically for about 30 years out of Ireland. I came back to Ireland in 2004 and just really tried to look the place in the eye a bit more. The book, the poems that I wrote over the last 7 years basically fell into experience coming out of the Republic of Ireland, which I was born and grew up in, and other poems that came out of the north of Ireland, which I married into, and a third group of poems, which are called Elsewhere. Which are really about that kind of hinterlands, if you like, that every so often entered my consciousness and became, it was kind of the enlarging side for me of my life when Ireland became too claustrophobic. And I think I've tried to explain a little about its origins. But I'd just like to read a few poems that come out of the second section, which are Ulster poems, if you like. And one of the things that has happened to me almost accidentally in my life, Billy mentioned that I'd lived away from Ireland quite a lot. I lived in Africa and Asia after I left university. I was teaching in Africa in a teacher's college, and I was working with refugees in Asia. One of the strange things that happened to me is that I found myself living in places where history, the wave of history, had kind of rolled through, and there was a kind of aftermath in these places. For example, in Nigeria, the civil war had just finished when I went out there as a young teacher in the late 1970s. And when I lived in the Far East, it was just at the end of the period when the Khmer Rouge had massacred a million people in Cambodia. It was kind of strange to be in a place where history, with a capital H, if you like, had just rolled through, and there was a sort of a quietening down in a strange way. As it happens, going into Northern Ireland was a similar experience, because I lived through the very end of the Troubles there, and kind of watched that wave recede a little bit. I don't want to exaggerate this, but there was a move away, if you like, from history with a capital H to what I would call just time. You know, all that was left was time, and history had kind of moved away. And it was almost as if the old cyclical patterns of living in a landscape had come back again once the sort of the thunderstorm had moved a little further off. I just thought I'd read a couple of poems out of that sensation. This is called Deep Ulster. It was here, the elemental centre, all the time, eternally present, repeating itself like seasons, where the times and dates for swallows and household fires are written down. The grouse are counted, the quotas of stocked rainbows. All that love of order for its own sake. Only the hill farms and the high sheep country above politics. The enormous relief up there as the dialect names of skies return, along with their clouds, and the old knowledge opens the mind again. To dream, to just potter in the yard, to fiddle with local stations in the kitchen, where news that is no news, finally, at last, fills up the ears with pure existence. Lit from beneath, the fields are evenings long. The tree by the house where Vladimir and Estragon kept vigil, with the stillness of commando and insurgent, frightens no one. Slow through the air, a heron, shouldering aside the weight of the world, is making for its colonies, coevals in a state plantation. Nowhere but here, in the high right hand of Ireland, do the weather fronts give way so slowly to such ambivalent light. There's a great old pub just in the hills behind Loch Ney, and behind Toome, which is where my wife's people are from, and it's called the Cross Keys. It's very well known just now for traditional music, but it's a very old. It was originally one of these coaching inns, which was part of the original route from Belfast to Derry. And it was one of those places where the horses were changed. During the Troubles, it was burnt down, or partly burnt down. And there was a rumour that it had been burnt down deliberately for the insurance money. And in fact, it was rebuilt, and it looks incredibly perfect. And it's got all the old paraphernalia of the stables and the horses still lying around, so it's a perfect replica, if you like, of something that underwent trial by fire, if you like. And this is called At the Cross Keys. What are you doing up here, young man, in the high country behind Loch Ney, where the pub, according to plan, burned down for the insurance pay? Whitewash and a gravelled yard, the same folk history on the walls, and the the barmaid, singed blonde hair, proof that it happened after all. Bathed in her own reflected glory, men are drinking. Slow time, the colour of Jameson, Jim Beam, drips from the optics. Where is history now, as the harvesters drone outside, and the wheel of the seasons after midnight spins out blizzards of chaff in the sonnet lumière fields of June? How did they live it? The sheet of flame each passed through, without moving, without speaking. Someone would cover it, they knew. Somebody settled the claim, and the quality of their silence alone might modify one eye blink as they waited to die in this hitching post on the high, cold miles, Belfast to Derry, their conflagration behind them, their horses still to be fed or changed at Hames on the Wall for the unforeseeable country ahead. I wanted to read one more poem out of that, that watery landscape. As you might have gathered, my own maternal ancestry was quite scattered, and I married into what might almost be described as a matriarchal line, a very, very solidly rooted line of people. There's a tremendous feeling, it's almost an erotic feeling of being absorbed into such a rootedness after your own line has been so scattered. This is a poem that just tries to celebrate that, partly that landscape, that watery, melancholic, grey, amphibious landscape around Loch Ney, and partly the sense of almost the old terrible joke about being married as being buried with somebody else's people. And as it's always pointed out to me up there, there's a particular place waiting for me, and so I'll never let forget that the earth of that place has me. Than the eye. This is called burial with your people. Mine are scattered everywhere, but yours. On the lee side of Carrigan Hill, a windbreak from eternity, wet clay, the cladding from my bones, unfolds itself. Maternal ground I have wandered the earth for all my life. A plot the size of a double bed, I lay myself down in tonight, unzipped in my birthday suit. I should never have got you talking on any of this. Even there, you whisper, my hand will stray, and I feel it creeping along my thigh, in death as in life, an earth spirit working its protective magic about me, till I yearn for the little death foreshadowing the greater. Tendrils, taproots, tingling ions of sex and death in the country dark. Now I suppose I will never wake to anything more than perpetual half-light, where the rain and squalls, like Jesus Christ, goes waltzing on the waters of Loch Ney. contrary cousins snooze in adjacent rooms, adjacent coffins. Blacked out while we go about our natural work of roots and continuities. And I hear you whisper, how does it feel to be buried with my people? For the millionth time, to say yes, as once long ago I must have done, was to take the plunge into more than marriage. I'd just like to round this out with two poems. One of them, another poem about marriage, which is an extremely difficult thing to write about. I have a feeling that, in fact, I know most love poems are poems. Very often, they're poems of the erotic instinct. They're poems that often depend on a moment, a very intense moment. You know, it could be two people kissing on a street on a rainy night or something like that. And into that moment, everything flows, if you know what I mean. If the words are right, the resonance from that is colossal, you know. But I'm also interested in love as a kind of a continuity rather than a moment, if you know what I mean. A journey rather than an instant. And trying to write about that is an extremely interesting process. There are actually some wonderful examples back in 17th century English poetry. There's a wonderful poem called Exequy by Bishop King, where he laments the passing of his wife and hopes to meet her again in the next life. And he sees every day as a getting nearer to that west. He rises nearer the west, not the east, in order to be closer to his beloved, who's passed away. There would have been a time when that kind of poem, or Milton's poem about his wife, who he sees in a vision, coming to him in a nightdress, and then she vanishes, and he wakes up and he realises he's blind and he's in darkness. There would have been a time when a poem like that might have seemed dull, but I think the weight of experience behind that kind of love poem becomes increasingly interesting as you move into those years yourself. And this is a poem. It's called The Double Chairs, Mount Melleray, and it's kind of an attempt to write a 17th century love poem in the 21st century. And I'm sure many of you know Mount Melleray in Waterford. This is a poem. Actually, it's a place that has been mentioned by a number of poets. I think Derek Mahon, who lives in Kinsale, talks a little bit about visiting Mount Melleray, and certainly Sean Dunne went there quite a lot. And I have a feeling the monks have developed a kind of a sixth sense at this point when they see poets approaching, looking for maybe the kind of sanctuary that might not always seem to be what they have on offer. And Derek Madden has written quite humorously about the misunderstandings that can occur when poets go looking in monasteries for things that maybe the monks don't particularly have on hand to give them. But this is about going into the church in Mount Melleray, which has two magnificent wooden chairs facing the church, and just being there in a moment of silence after a number of years of marriage and travelling and, you know, existence together. And it's called The Double Chairs, Mount Melleray. When the great door slams on 20 years of marriage and we collect ourselves, let's settle like the holders of holy office before us in the two great wooden chairs at the head of a soundless nave, alone together. Speech is irrelevant. Corridors, footsteps. All the noise of the world going on outside. The yard work, field work, in the long summer meadows, sloping away from the Knockmill Downs to the wrong infinity. God, they say, exacting his revenge on Sunday afternoon for the neglect of Sunday morning, in the carsick boredom of children, the cooling blood between husbands, wives. Incline to me here, but only a little, for I know you well, and listen for the knock of silence echoing in the wooden depths of the heart. Silence after all the high church music, tin pan alley in the kitchen, ambient in bed, all the refracted days like stained glass windows seen from the inside, yellows, blues and reds, the clatter of feet on the afternoon stairs, the chopping of garlic on wooden boards, the speechless rustle of how many thousand pages being turned before the great lights out on epithalamion exequy. Brethren, dearly beloved, you who come and go on either side of our walled-in silence, changing the flowers on the altar, hurrying your children through the darkened corridors, the mountains of the V, the married, the celibate, each a dream of the other. Leave us here a moment. Let us be. Thank you very much for listening. I know the night is moving on, and I really appreciate your attention. I'd just like to finish, as I said, with a poem that comes out of Cork, comes out of 20 years ago, and it's kind of a homage to a poet I knew at the time, and some of you, I'm sure, will have read, if you didn't know him personally. I'm talking about Sean Dunn, who I mentioned in connection with Mount Mellery. And Sean was one of those people who was not only a fine poet and a very good journalist, but he was also what you might call a religious seeker, in a way. And I sometimes feel, Sean, if circumstances had worked out a little bit differently for him, in his earlier life might have actually become a contemplative. As it was, he used to spend quite a lot of time up in Mount Mellery, and he had, of course, a family in Cork, and a busy, not to say a turbulent, life here. And he's much mourned, and died very, very suddenly and tragically at the age of 39, died in his sleep, at exactly the same age that his mother died. His mother had died when he was a child, also at the age of 39. Sean wrote a beautiful account of his religious seeking in a little book called The Road to Silence, in which he talks about trying out different churches and being unsatisfied with the form of Christianity that he'd grown up in and so on, and looking around for something different. I'm sure when my wife and I were living in Paris, Sean used to come over and used to spend time in what was then the Irish College, and he would go down the hill of the Mont Saint-Genevieve to a church called Saint-Gervais, which was across the Seine, and it was a church in which an order, a religious order, who were quite austere, but they were. That they believed in the desert in the city, basically. The desert was in the city, and that was where your ministry was supposed to be. And their services were very long and very austere and very beautiful. And he used to go regularly to these, and he often said that he considered this as a mode of religious belief that he could subscribe to. I last met Sean downstairs in the bar here in the Long Valley in February of 1995. We had a chat, a very quiet moment. And a few months later, I got the call in Paris to say that Sean had passed away. So this is just a memory of Sean and of Cork at that time. And it's called Mont Saint-Genevieve. In memory of Sean Dunn, 1956-1995. If days, as they say, are one long application, I into not I, wearing away the mountain underfoot, then let it slide, this complex of establishments, the shops on the steep street downwards, the restaurants, ethnic, local, and the pubs, the Russian bookstore with its emigre texts, the pretty, unapproachable women of the Latin Quarter, Sunday morning heat, the philosophes, bohemian, effete, the whole back catalogue of modern jazz, like scree off an Irish hillside. Knock me downs, or comers maybe. Either way, you are one of the ghostly now. Inaudible feet on an ageless treadmill. Better still, select of the company of Mara Marais, Viola da Gamba, celebrant here in another century, or Gabrielle Marcel, who paused for thought. It came to me on the Mont Saint-Genevieve, driven, like yourself, by the need to believe. The bottom of the hill at Maubert Metro. The first mushrooms of autumn in the Sunday market. A young Vietnamese in her sunken tea room laying out white china, bowls and teapot, steaming green infusion at the heart of heat-rattled city. The small thing done well. One of your many stations, Sean, the halfway house of accurate practice before the full-blown ritual over the river. White, shrouded figures, members of the Order of Desert Silence at the heart of Paris, motionless, and your mind drifting in and out of the mysteries to its own concerns, like our time together years ago, one winter evening in Cork, over glasses in the silence of the Long Valley, half full, half empty. Then, as now, no need for anything spoken. Only the mind worn down like ancient stone by repetition and monotony, and the endless patter of the ego fallen silent at last, through suffering, through tiredness, through the plain chant of days and the endless sway of chorus and antiphon.